Okay, we're now down to 1 Corinthians 7, the marriage chapter. This is always an interesting section. Should you marry? Should you not marry? Who should you marry? Why should you marry? What's the purpose of marriage? Now, as we will see as we go through this, the Apostle Paul had been asked a number of questions. And here's another indication that he and this congregation had been communicating back and forth with each other. In verse 1, "Now concerning the things which you wrote to me." Now, in the last chapter, we had seen that he had written to them before. Now, it indicates they had written to him. "It's good for a man not to touch a woman." Anybody like to explain to me what it means not to touch a woman? You want to come up here and say that in the microphone? Well, it's not talking about running around saying, "I touched you." What it is talking about is being sexually involved with a woman. Not to touch her inappropriately, it's saying. Because how do we know this? Well, verse 2. "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality," again the word is parneia, "let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband." So in order to avoid sexual immorality, lust, passion, all of those type of things, he says you should have a wife or a husband. Now in verses 2 through 7, we see the sexual obligations in marriage, and we see that sex in marriage should not be used as a weapon to get your own way. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. What does it mean to render to his wife the affection due her? Is this hugs and kisses and all around? Well, it could include that and should include that. It's another term for this would be conjugal duties. Hopefully everybody understands conjugal. Conjugal duties. And the wife, it goes on to say, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body. In other words, she doesn't exercise complete control over her own body. But the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body. But the wife does. When you get married, you become one flesh. And part of that one flesh relationship is the conjugal duties that one would perform within a marriage, the proper relationship sexually. And it's saying that you do not deprive the other because your mate has authority over your body when it comes to this area. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time. So it's saying you should not withhold relationships from one another except with consent, where both of you consent to it, and only for a period of time. That you may give yourself... Now, under what circumstances does Paul say this? Well, that you might give yourself to fasting and prayer. What if the two of you were going to fast and pray for 3 or 4 days? And, you know, you were really going to devote yourself to that? Well, then he said, okay, you know, you may agree that, well, look, let's abstain during this period of time. But after that, he says, come together again so that Satan does not tempt you. That Satan would tempt you to lust or commit adultery because of your lack of self-control. Not controlling their thoughts or their emotions or desires. But this I say as a concession, not as a commandment. There's nowhere that this was commanded or commanded, but he's giving his judgment and reason here on this. For I wish that all men were even as myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one to in this manner and another in that. Paul is saying he wished they were all like him, single, not married. As I said, at one time, apparently, Paul had been married. But you have to understand some of the comments that Paul makes in this chapter by a couple of verses that come later. And what I mean is verse 26, I suppose, therefore, that this is good, because of the present distress. That is, it is good for a man to remain as he is. So apparently they were under some type of persecution, trouble, trials, stress. And so he's saying that, you know, under this present distress, it'd be better to remain as you are. Verse 29, this I say, brethren, the time is short. So that from now on, even those who have wives should be as though they had none. So there was something going on that's not revealed to us in Corinth that gave Paul a reason for writing the way that he did. Because we know the scripture is very clear that God created man and woman in the very beginning. And God said, it's not good for a man to be alone. I'll make a helpmeet for him. So that wasn't God's purpose, that man be alone from the very beginning. He made a woman. He told them to marry, become one flesh, increase and multiply. So, you know, that's what God had intended from the very beginning. Now in verses 8 and 9, he speaks or gives instruction to the unmarried. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, a widow would be unmarried, it is good for them to remain even as I am. Meaning he was not married. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they're having trouble controlling their thoughts, their passions, their lusts, their desires, their sexual drives, you know, this type of thing. Let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So it is better to go ahead and just get married than to have this problem of burning with passion. Now verses 10 and 11, he gives instruction to the married. Now to the married, he says, I command, yet not I, but the Lord. In this case, he can refer back to what Christ said. Now, to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. The word depart in the Greek means just that, to separate, to divide, part, put asunder, to separate oneself from, to depart. To leave a husband and wife, a divorce, to depart, to go away. Now, this is used 13 times, you find in the New Testament. It's used in Matthew 19, verse 6. I'll just refer to a couple of these. Let's go back and read those, because we'll refer to these later. Matthew 19, this is where Christ gave the instructions. Verse 6. So then longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. King James Version says put asunder. Same word. So, you know, he's saying that if God's put them together, joined them, if they're married, then they should not be put asunder. Same thing is mentioned in Mark 10. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And then also here in verses 10 and 11, we find this word used, as well as in verse 15. The same Greek word is used in all three of those. So what he's saying, if you're married, then a wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, so she leaves him, she separates, or she divorces him, let her remain unmarried. So in this case, the indication is, when it says she departed, she has severed the relationship with her husband. She is to remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. Now, what he's dealing with here are two people in the church. Two people, a man and a woman, are both part of the body. They're married. For some reason, they can't get along. So they separate. Maybe they ultimately divorce. They are not free to remarry. They either have to remain unmarried or reconcile. So when you make the decision to get married and you marry somebody in the church, you need to make sure you understand the consequences. That marriage is until death do you part. And there are only two reasons why the marriage might be broken, and we'll cover those. And what I say to you, if you're not married and you're planning to get married, that you need to thoroughly understand with your potential mate these two reasons before you get married, so that there is no deception, fraud, or any reason for doing this. So what he's talking about, if she departs, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. The word divorce here is a different Greek word, as you can see here. And this particular word has to do with divorce. Means to send away, to bid going away, or to depart. Of a husband divorcing his wife, to send forth, yield up, or to expire. So in either way, you're not to depart or to divorce. A husband should not divorce his wife. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say. Now he's about to address the rest. And who are the rest? The rest are composed of those where one mate's in the church, the other mate is unconverted. So you have a marriage where one is converted, one is not converted. And he does not have any instruction from the Lord here. So therefore, he says to the rest, I, not the Lord, say. He can't go back and quote anything that Jesus Christ said on this. So therefore, he's going to give his judgment on this. Now, I have given to you an article written by Fred Kellers addressing the subject, who are the unbelievers in 1 Corinthians 7? And we won't go through that. I'll explain it, but you'll have the article as a backup article. And it goes through and explains quite a bit in this chapter. I just thought that would be a good resource for you to have. So notice what he says. To the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if a brother has a wife who does not believe, so she's a non-believer, same word that's used for infidel. So, she doesn't believe. And she is willing to dwell with him, Or as some of the other translations, King James Version says, she is pleased to dwell with him, or she's willing to dwell with him. In other words, in spite of his religion, in spite of what he believes, in spite of the fact he keeps the Sabbath and holy days and so on, she's willing to live with him. Let him not divorce her. Just because she's unconverted is not a reason for a divorce. Can't just up and divorce her for that reason. And if a woman who has a husband who does not believe, so he's a non-believer, if he is willing to live with her, or he's pleased to dwell with her, let her not divorce him. So the word divorce in 11, 12, and 13 are all the same word here. Now, the word pleased to dwell, notice, this word in the Greek means to be pleased together with, to approve together with, to be pleased at the same time with, consent, agree, to applaud. Or as if you were attending a concert and you really liked the music being played, you'd probably applaud it. It would please you. This is what it's talking about. So when it says they're willing to live with you, this means they're willing to accept your religion. They may not accept it in believing it, because they're obviously non-believers, but they're not going to cause you so many problems and heartaches that, you know, you, it's not worth living with them. Verse 14 says, for the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. The word sanctified means to be separated from the profane and dedicated to God. Do you realize that when one member in the family is converted, the husband or the wife, that the mate then is in a separate category? They're not categorized like everybody else in the world who's totally unconverted. They're set apart. And they could come to God. They're not cut off from God. Access to God is made possible. Then it says, going on here, otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. The word unclean means that. It means unclean in thought, life, action. That they're just simply not clean. But notice it says they are holy. I want you to notice the word sanctify and the word holy are very close. They come from the same root. One is in the Greek, here in the expanded Strong's definition. Sanctified is 37, holy is 40. Hagios and hagiazo. And hagios refers, it's the word that is used for saints, translated saint in the Bible. Holy ones, and it means most holy things, a saint. So where there is one member of the family converted, the children then are holy. Meaning, your children have a chance. They're in a different category. They're not like the children in the world who are totally cut off from God, sitting under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They now have access to the tree of life because their parent has access to the tree of life. And they could be called. And I think this is a wonderful blessing. And it's another reason why, if you're married, you have an unconverted mate, to stay together, because you don't know if that person might be called. And many a mate has been called by the example of the converted mate, where one was converted, lived a good life, and by their example, they were able to, set such a good example, the other began to inquire, began to look into it. Now we come down to one of the reasons mentioned in the Bible why a Christian can get a divorce. There are two basic reasons, and one is mentioned here. If the believer depart, same word we had, chorizo, to separate, divide, divorce, depart. If the unbelieving depart, let him depart, let him separate. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Now notice the word for bondage here means to make a slave of or reduce to bondage. Now, are you a slave when you get married? Do you become a slave to your mate? Well, notice the second part of this definition. Metaphorically, to give myself wholly to one's needs and services. When you get married, you are devoted to your mate, to serve them, to help them, to look after their needs in sickness and in health. If we're richer or poor, you know, on and on. So, in essence, this is saying that if the unbelieving depart, then the converted mate is no longer under bondage, no longer required to perform this type of a servitude, wholly looking after the needs and serving that other person. They would be free to remarry. Now, I mentioned the last time the article on divorce and remarriage. Let me just highlight a couple of things out of this. This may have already been covered with you, but this is a good place, I think, to cover it. If I don't answer your question, Caleb, I'll come back here. It says, while the Old Testament allowed for divorce, Christ explained that this was due to the hardness of their hearts because they were unconverted. Their hearts were hardened. He went on to explain that divorce was not the intent from the beginning. God's intent has always been that marriage is for life. Yet the New Testament does define two cases where divorce and subsequent remarriage were acceptable without the results being declared sin. One is, number one, sexual immorality. Number two, an unbeliever not pleased to dwell with a believer. Matthew 19:9 is the first place, sexual immorality. And I'll just read that. We referred to part of it earlier. Matthew chapter 19, verse 9. I say to you that whoever divorces his wife, except for, so there's an exception, except for sexual immorality, the word is porneia, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her, that is divorce, commits adultery. So, those two reasons. The first case deals with sexual immorality as stated in Matthew 19:19. The word is porneia. The word porneia, it goes on to say, is a reference to any type of sexual immorality, including adultery. Christ's statement in Matthew 19 can include all forms of sexual misconduct. Now, some of you might remember that prior to 1974, is when the decision was rendered in the church, that anyone who came into the church, and I'd been a minister by this time, about 11 years, anytime you visited a new person and they were about ready to be baptized, one question you always had to ask was, have you been married before? And if they had been married before, we would go through their marriages and try to determine which one they were married to. The reason we only at that time recognized one reason for divorce, that was Matthew 19:9, and we were going by what the King James Version said, King James Version says, except for fornication. And so we define that to mean that the only reason why a marriage could be declared invalid and not binding was if one of the mates had committed fornication, that's premarital sex, and did not tell the other mate, deceived them, therefore they would be free to remarry. And then, you know, sometimes you'd get into marriages where there were four or five people and you'd have to try to determine, okay, your first mate, were they married before? And if they were, was their mate married before? And, I mean, you get into all of this labyrinth. And we went through all of this. Well, 1974, that was all changed. At that time, we recognized that the word fornication is porneia, and that porneia is not limited to premarital sex. It means sexual immorality of any kind. And it can include adultery. The Greek word for adultery, which just means adultery, is mocheia. Porneia refers to sexual immorality, includes fornication, adultery, lesbianism, any type of sexual perversion, you know, anything. So we came to recognize from 1 Corinthians 7 that there was a second reason. There were also two other major changes that I'll get to here as we go through this. So in summary, sexual misconduct would be grounds for divorce, although in general, there would be an effort to save the marriage if the conduct is not habitual. Meaning, what if the mate slipped up and committed adultery? Maybe they did it a couple of times. They saw they were wrong. They repent. They're never going to do it again. And, you know, one should be willing to forgive and move on. But if it's a habitual, and, you know, it's something that a person is doing, then you have the right to put them away. Christ gave this as the exception clause. If a divorce does occur, remarriage is possible without it being considered adultery under these conditions. Now, the second case is found in 1 Corinthians 7 and deals with an unbelieving mate divorcing a believer. Now, they quote the Bible Knowledge Commentary here. It says, however, there were exceptions to the rule of no divorce. If the unbeliever insisted on a divorce, he was not to be denied. Should this occur, the Christian was not bound to maintain the marriage, but was free to remarry again. It says, Paul addresses a series of questions here. And he speaks to the rest, as I mentioned to you. So these two reasons the church recognizes, sexual immorality and the unbeliever leaving, are reasons for divorce. Now there's another reason. It's called annulment. Annulment, let me discuss this. In any discussion of divorce and remarriage, we should at least consider the concept of annulment. In the case of annulment, you have a fraudulent marriage, meaning that even though they were married, went through the form ceremony, God did not bind them. Why? Because there was fraud involved. There was deception involved. In the case of annulment, you have a fraudulent marriage which is put aside. This is different from a divorce, although a divorce may be required to break the contract. You know, you may still have to go through a divorce. Talking about from God's perspective. In general, annulment comes into play when there's been a deception. What biblical example do we have of this? Joseph and Mary. Joseph and Mary were married. They were engaged, in a sense. There was a period of time that they waited, actually, to see if there had been any hanky-panky going on. And what happens? Here's Joseph. He thinks he's marrying a virgin. And she's pregnant. Now, what was Joseph supposed to think? Immaculate conception. Is that what most people think of when they see somebody pregnant? You know, God impregnated, you know, this woman. Well, of course, he didn't think that. So he was, what does it say? He was mindful to put her away, being a just man. He was not going to make a public spectacle of her. He was going to set the marriage aside because he thought she has not been faithful. God appeared, or an angel appeared in a dream and said, you know, don't be afraid to take her for your wife, because what has been conceived, he was not a man, but is of God. So God had to explain this to him. Now, what is deception? Deception is when a couple get married, you withhold information from that person, which if they knew, they would not marry you. It could be, let me illustrate. It could be a simple matter of saying, well, are you a virgin? And you say no. But what if you'd been a prostitute? That's a little more than not being a virgin. You know, if you'd been a prostitute, you should say, let me just explain. You know, I did this for a couple of years. Not, you know, God called me. I'm really sorry. You know, I haven't done it since, you know, I've been in the church. Other deceptions. You're mentally ill, and you withhold that. You're an alcoholic, and you withhold that information. You are addicted to drugs, and you withhold that information. Doesn't mean that they wouldn't necessarily marry you, but they have the right to know before they get married. So before you get married, one, you need to discuss with your mate whether you are a virgin or not. Now, let me just caution, that doesn't mean, and no one has the right to say, okay, tell me time, place, individuals, how many, so on and so on. That's ludicrous. You're talking about, you know, you have a right to know if you're marrying a virgin or not, and that goes both ways, male, female. Then, both of you need to understand the grounds for a marriage being separated. You know, I mean, that being broken according to what the Bible says. Now, we have some questions stacked up here. First of all, Caleb. It is possible for a believer to revert to the unconverted state. I mean, that's a judgment that the church has to render. But we've had people come into the church, been baptized, stay for a while and leave, and totally give up their beliefs. We would consider them a non-believer. If they depart from the marriage, yes, then the believer would be free to remarry. But if both of them remain in the church, and just for some reason these two people probably should have never gotten married in the first place, then you have to remain single. You cannot remarry under those circumstances. Leah?
I was wondering, with the unbeliever not being able to develop a belief, what if when the two people were married, they were not in the church? Like, what if they got married before either one of them was, and then, you know, maybe one of them, they go to them at some point? Would that mean that, I don't know how to explain.
Well, yeah, you. What you're talking about, you're married before you're converted.
Right.
In fact, I was just coming to that section here in the write-up. The church accepts you in whatever state you are. Whether you're divorced, you're free to remarry when you come in the church. If you're married, the church accepts you married. Whatever state you're in. That was also a understanding that we came in 1974, and that was to recognize that at baptism, God forgives what you've done in the past that was wrong. We used to say, well, God would forgive everything but marriage. And whatever happened in that marriage, you know, you were, you know, we would make a judgment or render a judgment on it. Well, in this particular case, let me just turn to that. Divorce prior to conversion.
But I was saying, if
Okay, well, if they're Baptist, let's say they were married before they came in the church. Well, let's do both scenarios. They both come in the church. Well, what the Bible says here in verses 10 and 11 apply to them. In other words, they come in the church, they should not divorce. If one of them comes in, the other one doesn't, which is what happens most of the time. I mean, most people who come into the church already married. And so, you know, these principles apply to them here, to the rest. You know, the same principle would apply that he's speaking here. Let me just read this one section, and we'll come back to you here. It says, an additional concern that must be addressed deals with individuals who were married and divorced prior to their calling and conversion. Paul confirms that repentance, forgiveness, baptism provides new converts with a fresh start. And they are not bound to past sins in marriage any more than they are to any other sins. Therefore, a newly converted person is accepted in his current status, whatever his current status might be. So to summarize the church's teaching, two reasons for divorce, porneia, not pleased to dwell. We're talking about the believer. It also talks here about the believer who separates. We covered annulment, which is fraud or deception taking place, and the people are accepted in their current marriage status when they come in. Okay, you had a question.
Yeah, I know that there are a few cases where this happens, but where one person in the marriage wants a divorce, another one wants to stay married in some way, shape, or another. And so when they divorce, is the one held accountable that never wanted that divorce is still held accountable for that? Are they still not allowed to be married? Or?
Well, if they both are in the church,
it doesn't matter.
Now, we would have to look long and hard. You see, each situation is an individual judgment. That's why we have a book of principles here. And if everything were written down in a Talmud, this is what the Jews tried to do. Every situation you could ever think of, they wrote it down. So you just turn to the book. And you got a Talmud, and it tells you what to do. Well, that's true. We just stick all this in a computer and do away with the ministry. You know, you don't need it. But there are judgments that have to be rendered based upon God's law. Now, I'd say 40 years of judging divorce and remarriage cases, I've handled dozens and dozens of these over the years. I don't think I've ever had one reversed, you know, that I personally made a judgment on. But the way our divorce situation is set up in the church today, we always start at the lowest level. Local pastor will sit down with the couple. And if there is a desire on one mate to reconcile and the other doesn't, then why? I mean, that then becomes a problem. Why don't they not want to reconcile? And then you have to begin to deal with that. You begin to deal with people and where they are and what their motives, you know, why are they doing what they're doing. And sometimes you will find that people are, you know, they just want to divorce this person so they can go off and do their own thing. That obviously that'd be wrong, but maybe it's been a matter that they've been married 20 years. They fought night and day. They've never been able to get along. This person says, well, yes, you know, I'm willing, but really they're not. You know, they'd like to stay in the marriage because the wife is waiting on them hand and foot and cooking for them. All they want is a slave. But, you know, she's looking for a husband who would provide affection, attention, who would not only just take care of her physical needs, but nurture her, look after her, and he's not doing it, never will, and she knows that. So you got to take all of those things into consideration. Jason? Okay, we have, that's a very good question. It is permissible. In fact, if you'll go back and read this divorce and remarriage paper, you'll see that question covered. It is permissible for the converted person to initiate the divorce and the separation. Let me give you a classic example. We had a lady in one church area that I pastored whose husband was abusive to her. And every minister, there had been two prior pastors who had told her that she did not have to stay in that abusive situation. I mean, he would hit her, he'd knock her down, he'd come in drunk and kick her. One day he came in and picked up, he was drunk, he picked up a 250-pound coffee table, held it over her head, and was about to crush her skull with it. He got out of his car once in the garage and threw a screwdriver at her and just went right by her ear. If it had stuck her in the head, she would have been dead, stuck in the wall. I said, you should not put up with this. And so she finally left him and initiated the divorce. Now, why? He showed by his actions that he was not pleased to dwell with her. He might have said he was, but the way he treated her, how he abused her, said the exact opposite. So sometimes we have to, in the ministry, judge whether a person truly is pleased to dwell with them or not. Because a lot of times that, they're saying it, but they're not living it. So you have to tell by a person's actions, not just by what they say. Matthew? Matthew 19. If they're both converted, which isn't always true, but if they're both converted, they divorce and one remarries. Paul says you got to remain single. If they remarry, Christ said, if they remarry except for sexual immorality, and that has not occurred, let's say. Both are still believers. There's been no sexual immorality. Then that person is living in adultery because they are bound to the believer in God's eyes. So from God's perspective, they would be committing adultery. And whoever is married to them would be committing adultery. Jason.
This is another question. Doesn't this contradict what John the Baptist preached to Herod? Because he wasn't a believer. But he married out of his wife, didn't he?
Right. The problem was he married his brother's wife, which the Bible clearly in the Old Testament says you don't do. I've got three or two brothers. I don't go kill my brother and take his wife and marry her. That's a no-no on two accounts. But, that's what he was guilty of. So,
wasn't it the custom that if one of the brothers died, then the living brother was to take the wife?
Yeah, I mean, you find...
So in Herod's case, his brother was probably still living when he took his wife.
Yes. The problem is, it says if they don't have children. Now, this was to raise up children to the dead brother. Here's the dead brother. He doesn't have any heirs. In Israel, it's very important that the property pass on in the family. So, if you were the brother, you'd go marry him, his wife. I mean, he's dead now. If he's dead, free to remarry. And the first child would be accounted his heir. Second child would be your heir, and so on. So the idea was to raise up and have somebody who could inherit your property after you. So that's basically why that was done. Caleb?
What grounds for disfellowship? If
one remarried, that would be grounds, yes. Now again, you'd have to, you know, you don't just automatically go out and do something like that. You go talk and try to find out what exactly has gone on, you know, in these cases. That's why this is probably the most difficult area that the ministry has to deal with. And a lot of times there are situations that occur that we know all of the facts, but members don't. And so they see a certain situation unfolding in the local congregation. They assume that the church is allowing immorality or allowing certain things to take place, when we have had to look at the whole situation and judge, maybe been dealing with it over a long period of time. But they don't know those facts. And I've had people come up and demand. And I say, sorry, you're way out of line. You don't have any right to know the personal business of so-and-so. You wouldn't want me to come and tell you tell others all of your sins and faults and mistakes and things that you've done wrong. So somewhere you have to draw the line, and people have to have a little confidence that you know what you're doing. Okay, we were going to cover chapter 7 and 8 here this afternoon, but I will tell Mr. Kirkpatrick that he, begin in verse 17, because verse 16 says, "Oh, how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife?" As long as they're in the marriage, there's a possibility they could be converted, because they're not totally cut off from God.